Off with a southern resident killer whale briefing by Julie Watson.
Hello, good morning. Thank you, Chair Carpenter. Good morning to the rest of the commission and Director Suswind and Deputy Director Windrup. I will be talking for a few minutes, so if those of you who are standing want chairs, I don't want to force you to stand the whole time, but it's up to you. And I realize that I'm between you and lunch, so I'll keep this fairly high level. This is an informational presentation on the status of the southern resident killer whales. I'm going to start with an introduction to killer whales and the status here in Washington State. And then we'll go into the Southern Resident Killer Whale Task Force, their recommendations, our work in the agency to implement those recommendations, and then a little bit about the Year 2 report that just came out last month. So killer whales live all around the world. They can be found in all the parts that are blue on the big map. But we have three ecotypes that live in Washington. There are the residents. Those are the ones you hear a lot about in the news. We also have transient orcas and offshore orcas. And I will tell you a little bit about all three types, and then we'll focus in on the southern residents. So orcas, males live to about 30 typically, but can live to 50 or 60 years. Females typically live to 50 years, but can live as long as 80 or 90 years. They reach maturity at around 10 to 13 years, and they are pregnant for around 15 to 18 months. They have calves that stay with them and nurse for a year, and females will have one birth in around every 5 years. We have three pods here in Washington State, J, K, and L pods, and those pods vary in sizes. I'll have more statistics on that coming up. Transient killer whales are different than the residents in that the residents eat salmon and other fish mostly. Transients really prefer to eat marine mammals such as harbor seals. They typically live out on the coast, but they've been coming into Puget Sound quite a bit. And then there are offshore killer whales. These ones live up to nine miles out from the coast, and we know a lot less about them. They've been studied a lot less. And they only really discovered them in 1988. They eat mostly sharks, so the picture on the bottom there is teeth that are worn down from chewing through shark skins. Looking at the status, again, of those three ecotypes, we have endangered state status for killer whales generally. Federally, the southern residents are considered endangered under the ESA, and the transients, one specific family, AT1s, are considered depleted. There's critical habitat designated for the southern residents. That happened in 2006, and NOAA NMFS is under, right now, reviewing an expansion of that critical habitat to cover the full range that the orcas use the whole way down to the California coast. And staff did work with other state agencies to write a letter supporting the expansion of that critical habitat and providing some recommendations for additional improvements. Okay. So here's a graph of the southern resident population over time. There used to be about 200 of these animals. We think lowest populations before the live captures started were about 140. The captures really, really dramatically reduced the species down to 70, and that's when we started counting them regularly. And you can see there over time when we had the state listing and the federal listing in 2000, sorry, 4 and 5, I think, respectively. Yeah. And so right now we're hovering at about 73 whales. And this is the latest statistics for all three pods. J pod had a baby born in May, or first seen in May of this year. Her name is Tofino. And then Whistle in L pod was first seen in Puget Sound in January. So two babies, but we also had three deaths this year in August, two adult males and one adult female, J17, who was the mother of J-35, the whale that pushed her dead calf around for 17 days in 2018. So obviously we've had a lot of reduction in the southern resident killer whale population, and that's led to a lot of interest in recovery. So the federal objective for downlisting is about 2.3 growth per year. And to delist, it would be 2.3% growth for 28 years. And that's about a whale and a half per year. The governor's southern resident killer whale task force, which I'll talk more about momentarily, they also have some goals, about a whale a year for 10 years. So 10 whales in 10 years. So that would bring the population status. Their goal was 84 whales by 2028. They also had short-term goals. It takes a little while to see a signal in whether this population is improving. So they wanted to see well-nourished whales, more live births, and survival of young calves. And those would be some indicators that we're making improvements towards increasing this population. Major threats include declines in prey availability. As I said, these guys really like to eat Chinook salmon, and so they've been having a harder and harder time finding food. They also deal with problems from bioaccumulation of contaminants in their food, which can cause more problems as these whales get hungry and they lose weight. More of those contaminants become available in their systems, and you see the occurrence of things like peanut head. And vessel interactions are another big area of focus, because the whales use echolocation to hunt, and they change their behavior quite a bit when vehicles are present. And then finally, oil spills, which would not be great. We have staff who work at DFW who are working on deterrence if there would be an oil spill, to keep the whales from entering that area. And then emerging threats, human population growth, and climate change. And I'll talk more about those when I talk about the year two task force work. So as you all know, Governor Inslee made the Southern Resident Killer Whale Task Force. These guys met for 2 years and now have concluded their work. You might see familiar faces in there. DFW was involved. Commissioner Smith was at the table. You can see him there. Also, Deputy Director Windrop was at the table in the commission, or the task force. And finally, the prey availability working group was led by Penny Becker, who is another one of our staff. Penny Becker was the killer whale lead. She's gone back to her role as wildlife diversity lead in the agency, and I've stepped in for phase two of this work. In year one, the priorities for the task force were those areas that we were just talking about: prey, contaminants, vessel noise and disturbance, and also sustained funding for this recovery effort. They came up with 36 recommendations in year one. That led to the governor having four bills and budget requests. What that looked like for us is we had the OFM requests mini decision packages after our budget was submitted, and we prepared those and sent them on, and several of those resulted in work for the agency, which is what I will talk about next. So we got funding to increase production of Chinook, coho, and other salmon by quite a bit. We got $13.54 million in general fund to do that. We also got $40 million to make capital improvements to hatcheries. And so I can answer a couple more questions about this later, but in general, we've increased our production quite a bit over time. And this will be sustained production annually, but these are the stats for the 2019 brood year. On the water, we've increased our patrols specific to having whale patrols. So our enforcement guys out on the water helping educate boaters to follow the new distance regulations. So we increased, the last legislative session, increased the distance boats could be from the southern residents from 200 yards to 300 yards, 400 front and back. And we are involved in a lot of education programs called Be Whale Wise, partnering with a lot of folks in the area to get the word out. And our enforcement folks have been a big part of that outreach effort. Interestingly, though, there were fewer of these whale patrols than expected, because the whales were absent a lot of the summer, and it's unknown. We have suspicions why they were not here, but we only had them 2 days in June and July, and there were over 50 consecutive days we didn't see them during parts of the year that they would normally be in the inland Puget Sound. But when they are here, and even when they're not, we're getting the word out. There's signs up at all of the docks so that people renting boats, recreational boaters, can also be following the new regulations, ensuring that they slow down to 7 knots in the vicinity of whales. And there's also a voluntary no-go zone by San Juan Island. Also related to vessels, we have commercial whale watching. The second substitute, Senate Bill 5577, created a new licensing program for commercial whale watching, and part of my role over the next year will be to work with stakeholder groups to develop rules for that licensing program. So we're getting up and running with a stakeholder advisory group, an intergovernmental coordination group, and there will be an independent science panel run through Washington State Academy of Sciences that will be producing a document with the best available science about vessel disturbance and noise. Protecting habitat. Earlier in the habitat committee updates, you got all the latest news on the HPA civil authority, so I won't go into much detail there, but that's a big part of the prey availability bill that passed this last session. You guys are also on the cutting edge of this one. Warm water predatory fish rulemaking. I don't have an update on this because I'm waiting to see what you do. But this is really important as it's part of this greater package of DFW representing and telling the story of how we're making progress for the killer whales and doing the things that the task force recommended. So looking forward to seeing what you guys decide on that. Salmon predation by pinnipeds. We've had two recent workshops. On the 1st of November, we met with the co-managers and had a discussion about all the latest science on pinniped populations, what they're eating, their diets, and also ecosystem interactions. And then we had an even bigger workshop later in November with scientists from both sides of the border. So we had the Canadians. It was here in Bellingham. We met for 2 days and talked about pinniped predation on salmon, how that might relate to killer whales, and also what are some of the MMPA options for what that looks like. We do have the Columbia River recommendation. It was not funded. We're requesting funding for that again in this supplemental budget year. We do have our application under 120F submitted last May, and we're hearing it'll take probably about another year before we get final decisions on that.
Excuse me one moment. Commissioner Smith?
Yeah, thank you. Very informative. But
oh, sorry.
As these workshops come up around the regions, could you let the commissioners or the commission know, or let Nikki know? So, because I wasn't aware that was here, and I would have liked to have attended it.
Sure, yeah. Of course.
Commissioner Mikhajic.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Could you refresh our memory as to what the next steps are on the pinniped predation plan? You've got a couple of workshops here. Are there more workshops? And in the end, I can't recall, if you could refresh our memory, where this ends up.
Yes, so it's different, and I might be looking to Nate to help clarify here because he's very clear on this, but the workshops were focusing on Puget Sound, and Puget Sound is a very different situation than the Columbia River, where we have really definitive, like, single point of entry. We know which animals are causing problems and where, and so we're a lot further down the road with actually removing animals in the Columbia, whereas in Puget Sound, we're still exploring the science. It actually, from that workshop, it seemed like the Canadians might be in a better position to actually try out some experimental management efforts up there. Because one of the big takeaways that I got from that two-day workshop is that there's a lot of ecosystem impacts that we can't fully predict yet, and there's more science to be done to support whatever management decisions we might make in the future.
Commissioner Graybill and then Commissioner Thorburn.
Real quickly, when do you foresee us being able to take action on the Columbia River, on Pinhead,
Mr. Carpenter and Commissioner Graybill, so we currently have our 120 permit application that's a permit from NIMS to the states of Oregon and Washington and Idaho. So we're currently removing California sea lions there. We average about 20 animals a year on that removal during a two-month capture window in the spring. The Marine Mammal Protection Act was amended last year, and we submitted an application in May. NIMS had determined our application was sufficient, and they've started public comment, and then they've established or in the process of establishing a pinniped task force to review our applications. That task force will ultimately make recommendations to NIMS on whether or not the application is approved or not. We're told that that process will take about a year. And so we've submitted a supplemental budget request to ramp up our efforts instead of just 2 months for removing California sea lions to about 10 months for moving both Stellar sea lions and California sea lions. So,
and we already, as part of that, do they also approve the procedures that we use? Or since we've already been taking one species, the methodology is approved, so once they're in there?
Yes, sir. If once we have that permit, we'll be able to go. But I would say that handling Stellar sea lions that weigh up to 1,500 pounds is very different than handling California sea lions around 400 to 600 pounds. And so having the legislature approve the funding request for us to staff up, as well as have new barges and new equipment to be able to process animals of that size. I mean, there's a staff safety concern here on handling animals like this, as well as the geographic area under the amended MMPA and our new permit will expand. And so we will be able to do removals in tributaries of the Columbia where sea lions are preying on listed salmon. And so we'll need to be able to have equipment that we can move around and not just handle and process animals right there on Bonneville Dam.
My question takes us back to Puget Sound. Is all action targeting pinnipeds and behavior on hold, or are we proceeding with some non-lethal strategies? I know we've talked about pull-out sites and that sort of thing. Are we able to proceed with those? And it's simply the lethal that we're waiting to get more science on?
Yeah. Chairman Carpenter, Commissioner Thorburn, that's a great question. So we currently do not have any permit applications in place yet for some of the non-lethal measures for Puget Sound. We've been primarily focusing on some of the questions that we've been asked about what is the impact on smolt predation. And just kind of cut to the chase on harbor seals, they're consuming somewhere between an eighth to a quarter of the smolts that we estimated being produced in 2016, 17, and 18. So we now have a pretty comprehensive data set, pretty significant impact. Yeah. But then when you overlay the reality of the Marine Mammal Protection Act and the potential biological removals of harbor seals, kind of the estimate of the adult salmon saved, if you will, by removing up to the cap of potential biological removal, you might just be able to save a few thousand fish. So our focus now is, instead of looking at more of a kind of a population reduction, is looking at estuaries of concern and getting more finer scale analysis of what could be that benefit in those areas. And in addition, looking at forage fish, looking at what are those artificial haul-out sites. We've got a graduate student we're partnering with doing an inventory of those sites to see what opportunities might be there to dissuade pinnipeds from hauling out near areas of concern.
All right, just a couple more on this one. We have a dam and barrier analysis that we are doing right now. We have staff working on this in the Fish Passage Division, and they are doing an analysis by intersecting all of the streams that house the species of Chinook or the populations of Chinook that are listed in the NOAA report of what killer whales like to eat. They overlaid those streams with roads, and they got about 8,000 hits on the west side and 1,000 on the east side, and there's a lot of false positives there. And so their next phase of that project will be narrowing down that list, removing bridges, things that aren't actually barriers to fish passage. And then they're going to do a lot of iterative work with the local lead entities to ground truth and get submitted other potential barriers that might not have been captured by that analysis. And there'll be a big comprehensive list of all of the barriers that are relevant to the southern resident killer whales that we then can share back as a deliverable. On the fishways flows and screenings rulemaking, the last I heard on that one is that we're hiring someone within the Fish Passage Division to coordinate that rulemaking process. So it's a little bit of a stepwise process there. And a lot of this funding that we received this last year, legislative session, was one-time funding. So our supplemental budget request, of course, you guys know all about that, is really, really important for us to continue doing this killer whale recovery work. Just a little bit about the task force in year two. They had their last meeting in October, and they released their final report on November 8th. The governor's website has that report online, and it's pretty great, so recommend checking that out. This year, they focused on climate change and population growth and development, those two other major pressures that are putting pressure on the killer whale population. Also, they focused on what recommendations from 2018 do we need to double down on. And what does life, they called it life beyond the task force. The task force is disbanded, but how do we make sure that we're continuing to coordinate on killer whale recovery across the whole system? They added two new goals relative to the climate change and population growth. And then they came up with 13 new recommendations. That graph at the bottom is the population growth in Washington State and projected out into the future. The population in Washington has increased 20% over the last 30 years. So if you continue on that trend, we have a lot of people putting pressure on salmon habitat that's critical for the orcas to have enough food to survive. So they did focus on population growth, climate change, ocean acidification, and that was a big area of focus as well. And then within the contaminants realm, they really narrowed in on nutrients and sewage treatment as a potential area that could have impacts on contaminants in killer whales. These were some of the themes of the new recommendations. They talked about no net loss and net ecological gain under GMA, SMA. They talked about fast ferries. There's a growth in fast ferry traffic, and how do we make sure that those are quiet and not causing problems for the killer whales? Reducing emissions, talking about resilience of our systems to climate change and innovation. And then, as I was saying, nutrients, NPDES permits potentially for sewage treatment plants. That was one of the recommendations. And then having monitoring and reinforcement of the regulations around stormwater. What's next? We have a new legislative session coming up in January, and we're eager to see what the governor will propose, if there'll be new additional requests or legislation relative to the new recommendations. We do think that several of our partners will be working to bring forward different legislative requests, and the conversation will continue around net ecological gain. Implementation will continue. A lot of these projects that I mentioned are ongoing, and we will be looking forward to learning more about what the governor wants to do with the life after the task force. Will that be situated in GSRO? Will it be a separate body? How will the agencies continue to coordinate with the tribes on that implementation? So with that, I will open up to questions, and instead of leaving it on this side, we'll have a picture of a whale.
Commissioner Anderson, Commissioner Thorburn, Commissioner Smith, in that order, please.
A couple of questions. One may be fairly simple. The focus, obviously, on southern resident killer whale, but curious with regard to the rules regarding on-water enforcement and boundaries. Does that is it the same rule for, like, transients? What if there are transients there? Is a rule enforcement, law enforcement going to be treating it the same way as if they're southern residents?
No, the rules are specific to southern resident killer whales.
And so somehow somebody's going to know the difference?
Yes, that's a great question, Commissioner Anderson. Thank you. From what I understand, I'm not one of those people that knows quickly the difference, but the folks on the water who are out there all the time do. The whale watching community does, and a lot of their messaging has been around being indicators for recreational boaters who might not know. So they're setting the distance, and DFW enforcement can tell the difference, and they're also helping set the distance and educate people. Here's what species you're looking at. Soundwatch is another group that's out there educating boaters and talking to them about here's who's here, here's what you need to know about the regulations around these whales.
Second question is, thank you, is relates to the HPA single family exemption. Is that closing a loophole? Is that what that is? Can you explain that a little bit more?
Oh, Amy. I'll have Amy step in and take a stab at it versus me saying something incorrect. Thank you, Amy.
Thank you, Commissioner Anderson. This has been an ongoing challenge for us through the HPA process is having, the way it was written is that essentially we had no ability to say no to a single family residential development bulkhead. We could condition it, but we couldn't deny it. And so this actually provides the opportunity for the department to deny a permit. So I would think it is a bit like a loophole, yes.
Commissioner Thorburn?
On your listing status table, you note that the federal status of transients is depleted. What is that category?
That's a great question. So that particular population is from the Exxon Valdez oil spill. That's why they're depleted. And depleted is a status. And I might again look to Nate.
Is it under the marine mammal?
Under MMPA.
Yeah, okay. Yeah. Okay, thank you.
Yes.
Mr. Smith?
Are cormorants off the hook?
No.
Good call.
That's a great question. And I have not seen any recent recommendations or funded work to do anything from the task force. I'm looking to Amy again regarding cormorants. But I'm interested in hearing more of your thoughts and comments.
Well, as the commissioner knows, I've said it before, I've seen the effectiveness of really reducing cormorants in fish populations in the Great Lakes, where you have a 2 or 3 year turnaround, and where rafts of 1,000, 2,000 cormorants are out there. They can do a lot of damage. So there is precedent for large scale removal within Fish and Wildlife, U.S., of cormorant populations. And I know we talked about that off and on, you know, various birds, but cormorants are the big ones out there. But it just seems to, all the other guilty as charged are up there, but.
Thank you. That's a great point. I'd be interested in learning more of your thoughts on that and what you think the agency can be doing to support
that.
Yeah,
I would recommend just look at in the upper Great Lakes on the perch population. In Lake Huron, what the cormorant reduction.
Okay.
I witnessed it firsthand. That was both by oiling the eggs on rickery islands, and little island, nesting islands, and also by the old-fashioned, I'm sure it was steel shot, not lead, but...
It was, yeah, definitely.
There was a lot of booming. First day, I think the people enjoyed that. Second day, they probably couldn't move their arms.
Thank you.
Commissioner Kehoe and Commissioner McKaysey.
So, thank you, Chair Carpenter, and I just want to bring to everyone's attention, and we spoke last night, there is another process that is going on, and that's a federal process by National Marine Fisheries Service. And Chair Carpenter and I have been following this process for many years, in fact, before we were on, I know
very
before
much
I
so.
Was on the commission.
Likewise.
So just to give a little history, National Marine Fisheries Service had several proposals for rulemaking, related to vessel traffic. And One of the most controversial proposals had to do with the protection zone or the no-go zone. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, everyone can recall, of course, Commissioner Carpenter and I can recall that the National Marine Fisheries Service decided not to move forward with that recommendation or with that rule. There was a lot of public comment, and as I recall, National Marine Fisheries Service said, well, there's not public buy-in, and so that was not an option adopted. However, they definitely left the door open for that. A few years later, then certain environmental groups filed a petition with NOAA Fisheries, NIMFS, wanting to have them, petitioning them to start rulemaking on this no-go zone. And, you know, and I know my organization, Per Se Vessel Owners, we filed comments. I believe WDFW did as well. Nothing happened. This was several years ago. There was no move forward or anything like that. It was just nothing happened. And then some of these same NGOs recently sued NOAA Fisheries over their inaction in connection with this. And I just happened to, just before the commission meeting, I happened to look at the court file in this particular case, and I noticed, lo and behold, that the case has been dismissed. The plaintiffs voluntarily dismissed the case. And what they did is they acknowledged that National Marine Fisheries Service has agreed to restart the comment period, and this is my understanding. So comment period, and I'm pretty sure it's focused on this no-go zone. I know, and I won't speak for the members of the task force, but this was a topic that was talked about at great length, and it was not included as a recommendation. So just to let folks know that there is another process going on, that this issue will come up again, and I just want to make sure that the department is aware of that, and then the commission can, if appropriate, engage on what our position, WDFW's position, is on this very, very important topic to, in particular, this county, and for a lot of recreational folks that use that area. So, thank you.
To support what Commissioner Keogh said, we attended lots of meetings and hearings in Anacortes and Friday Harbor and the Seattle Aquarium, and with a lot of people. This is certainly prior to my time on the commission, and Commissioner Kehoe's colleagues as well. It was not well thought out. It was someone's idea of a fix. If that were to ever go forward, it pretty much shuts down the entire west side of San Juan Island, looking straight across at Sydney and Victoria. That would create quite a significant battle royal, I don't mind saying, and I hope we track it aggressively. So, Commissioner Kehoe, or Commissioner McKaysey, excuse me.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Before I ask my question, just to follow up on this matter, you say there's an open public comment period on this, or there's one planned. Do you know when that is?
Yeah, no, and I would thank you, Mr. Chair. I just saw a quick reference in the plaintiff's motion to voluntarily dismiss, and it talked about an agreement. I haven't seen the notice. Maybe we can get more information on that. Yeah. So
it closes December 23rd, the comment period.
So it's open now.
I'm sorry, say that again?
The comment period on the I'm one of the attorneys on the case that was dismissed, just to be clear. The comment period for the vessel regulations that NIMFS is considering, this is just a scoping, they don't have an actual rulemaking out yet, but the comment period for the scoping closes on December 23rd.
Well, if I may, I would on my behalf request Joe Panesco to please review this and report back to us. Keep us in the loop if you'd be kind enough.
Chair Carpenter, if I may, yeah. I have a slight update on this one. So there was a public meeting. There is this open public comment period that closes December 23rd. This is just the initial phase of should NIMS look at their vessel regulations and consider changing them. And just earlier this week, I had a conversation with the governor's office and the Puget Sound Partnership, and we, along with the Puget Sound Partnership, RCO, and GSRO, are planning to write a coordinated letter asking that NIMS does consider changing their vessel regulations and at least considering coming into alignment with the new state regulations and considering alignment with the Canadian side so that there's transboundary harmony. So we're drafting a letter at the moment and would be happy to take your input and to work with the Attorney General's office. They were involved in that call as well. From my understanding, the Governor's office and the AG are not at this point commenting because there's not a proposal on the table yet. This is just should we start talking about it, and we are planning to engage. Thank you.
Thank you for that. Commissioner Mukajic, were you finished?
No, my question has to do with your comment that as we move toward this next legislative session that maybe we don't have any proposals. Last time we were asked to develop some things, and we did participate in that. But you said our partners will likely bring forward requests, legislative requests. Could you elaborate on that, what they are and from whom?
I can very vaguely speak to it, and perhaps Deputy Director Windrop might want to add more. I believe that most of the state agencies were waiting for governor's requests of whether they wanted decision packages from us, and as we've not had those requests yet, we have not put anything forward, besides that we had some carryover requests from last year that we've kept in our supplemental budget request. I do believe some of the, when I say partners, I mean the broader task force, some of the members in the NGO community might be working with sponsors to bring things forward, but I don't have specifics.
Thank you, Commissioner McIsaac. What comes to mind for me is that there were a lot of the predominance of the recommendations for this round were less about our authorities and more about some of the other state agency authorities, for instance, Department of Ecology. So there were a fair number of contaminant recommendations that I think perhaps they're entertaining. And Julie's right that we're waiting for the signal, all the agencies are waiting for the signal from the governor's office of what are they going to request from us, given that these recommendations are to the governor's office, and then it's upon the governor's office to sort of say back, okay, therefore I want you to submit this or submit that.
Okay. No other questions? Thank you very much. Look forward to hearing more.
Thank you, Chair.